But we, you know, at least it wasn't raining and the snow had melted. So we thought we'd give it a go, and it was kind of fun. It wasn't as fun as it is when it's 80 degrees, but it was fun, and now it just makes me, I just want Vespa weather. That's what I'm going to start calling it, Vespa weather. Mark Mix from National Right to Work Foundation's on the phone with me right now. Mark's like, how is this going to relate to right to work? And it's not, Mark. It's just a complete non sequitur.
Well, Vicki, the picture of you with a scarf and gloves on a Vespa just completely blows my mind. I suspected Harley Davidson for you. I really did. I mean, goodness.
I'm zipping around on my Vespa going, ciao. Ciao.
Oh, no.
I have a Yamaha. I don't have a Harley. I have a Yamaha Virago 535. That's my motorcycle.
Okay.
I do have a motorcycle, but I'm getting old.
Okay.
I'm getting older. You know, I'm kind of slowing down a little bit. I don't have want to light my hair on fire or any of that. That my 535 Virago is going to light anybody's hair on fire. Anyway, Mark, good to have you. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be on with you again.
Come, let's come along to Wisconsin, shall we? First, I would like to invite Mark to discuss what recently became apparent, although still not widely reported at all in Wisconsin media, that the Attorney General Josh Call decided not to defend Wisconsin, the state law right to work, from a challenge by the Machinist Union, who are trying to find a way to create a loophole so they can keep collecting dues from members who do not want to pay dues. Drop-kicked an opportunity to have an appeal before the United States Supreme Court, and that just now renders Wisconsin one of those states where the unions can still, you know, they can still screw with people who want to get out.
Yeah, that's right. It's unfortunate because I think there was an opportunity, given the dissent in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals by Judge Mannion, that there was an opportunity to go back and revisit a 1971 case in the U.S. Supreme Court, a case called CPAC, that basically said that right-to-work laws deal with union membership or non-membership, and the dues checkoff is somehow outside of that context. And, of course, with the Wisconsin right-to-work law that was passed in 2015, the legislature included this ability for workers to exercise their rights under Wisconsin's right to work law within 30 days. They could say, look, okay, I'm getting out, and in 30 days you got to stop my dues checkoff. And there is a problem going back to the 1971 Supreme Court decision in cases that came out of Georgia and Arizona, other right to work states, where they tried to basically limit the impact of the right to work law. And there was an opportunity in this case, and the previous AG had filed a case and was going to appeal it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And right the day before they conferenced it, the unions and the AG and the governor in your case file a motion with the clerk, not even with the court, because they said we want to withdraw the case, and they do it without reference to any consideration of the court. They just drop the case and it's over. And that's really pretty amazing.
It's over. That means that the person who is the complainant here no longer has any hope for justice unless another case comes forward again, Mark, that's what I'm asking you guys about. Is there the potential, either through Wisconsin or another state, to bring this challenge back so that it can be potentially considered by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, we probably can, but it's difficult in Wisconsin because what's happened there, you have this kind of smoking pile of legal mess up there, and I don't mean to be mean to you, but this whole thing with the legislature in the lame duck session and limiting things, you know, that and trying to protect things with the new administration coming in, and, you know, then you had the Democratic AG campaigning before he was elected that he was going to enforce all the laws on the campaign trail, including lawsuits, right? He said that to the people of Wisconsin, and then he does this. But, yeah, what's happened in all of the legal actions surrounding this is that the state agency that has been given jurisdiction to enforce the right to work law is enjoined by the court from doing anything to enforce the right to work law in this regard to the dues checkoff. So it'd be really difficult to bring another one in Wisconsin. We will try it. We think there's a federal argument, and we're looking at that, and we've had a couple of calls already from some folks in Wisconsin about how we might proceed, but it may be that we need to go into we may need to bring a case from another state and get it back to the Supreme Court, because it was interesting, Vicki, one thing about the Supreme Court in the CPAC case back in 1971 is the rules and procedures for court action were a little different, and the Supreme Court affirmed a lower court ruling without even issuing any kind of an opinion. So it would be really useful to get back, and now under these new kind of rules and the way they operate, to have them, if they're going to defend it, if the court's going to keep it up, they might as well write a decision about why they would keep it up, as opposed to being absolutely silent, which is kind of rare.
How do people now in Wisconsin, as it stands, now that the Attorney General decided to abdicate his responsibility as Attorney General, how do people who want to get out of the union, where do they stand now if they made a decision maybe 5 years ago when they were told they had to join a union, and they went with automatic dues checkoff? Because, I mean, you can see that's probably happened to a lot of people.
Absolutely. You can still get out, but you just have to, you'd go by the federal standard, which is this 12-month. The union officials are allowed to maintain a checkoff authorization for 12 months. And then the problem with that, Vicki, is, you know, and we've got cases about this all over the place, including Wisconsin, where, you know, what is the window period? When does it start? When does it end? The unions control that process. They say, well, you can get out, you know, be ready for the second blue moon. I guess that's a blue moon. That's redundant. Get ready for the blue moon in the month, the second full moon of the month. And when that full moon starts to wane, if you haven't gotten out during that period, from the full moon to the waning moon, then you're out and you got to stay in for another 12 months. We argued a case in the Sixth Circuit on this. And basically what we said was, you know, when a person writes a letter to the union and says, I don't want to be a member anymore, and they even then they comply with this 12-month period, the court there, we argued that once you say no, that no should hold until you say you want back in, even when you've missed the window period, that letter should stay in their files. And the courts even said, no, you got to do it. You got to hit those goalposts each time.
So the unions can say, quite literally, they can say, all right, 12 months, and you have to do it between 7 a.m. and 11 a.m. on the third Tuesday of 1 month. They can do this. They can set the rules however they want. And if you've, you know, don't write down somewhere that you've got to do this or you can't get hold of somebody, potentially now you're wrapped in for another year.
Yeah, and I would say that's a little bit on the extreme side. They would probably get knocked out on something like that. But what happens sometimes is they say it's 12 months from your anniversary date. So you say, okay, when did I sign that card? Going back to your analogy or your scenario, you signed the card 5 years ago, the right to work law gets passed. 2 years later, you don't like something, you say, I want to get out. And they say, well, you can only do it on your anniversary date. And you ask them, okay, when did I sign the card? And they say, oh, let's get back to you on that. And they don't tell you when you signed the card, and they don't have to provide the evidence of when you signed the card. It's kind of a, you know, hit or miss. And
really?
We've got lots of cases like that. Yeah, it's a really fascinating process, and it's all designed to mitigate the impact of a right-to-work law and keep these workers, just as you said, paying union dues as long as possible.
Yeah, the whole point is the money, because
yeah,
they've got this little document that says they can keep taking money out of your bank account. You know, I guess I would ask this, Mark. I mean, I'm just sort of spitballing here. What if you closed one bank account and opened up another one?
Well, it's actually a card that the employer has you sign. It comes out of your bank account. It comes out of your paycheck is what it does. So they get it before you get the money. You haven't put it in
your bank.
It comes
out of your paycheck. So you're just screwed no matter what.
Well, I wouldn't say that. But
well,
yeah,
I would.
We'll keep fighting.
I
drive a Vespa. That's why.
Right. Because I'm tough that way. So, listen, they're cool. I'm just telling you, okay? They're hashtag super bueno. All right, now to another issue, and that is it seems to be the thing to be a presidential candidate, a Democratic presidential candidate, and announce that you want to see a repeal of all state right-to-work laws. And this could potentially actually happen. This is what people think. Well, we passed our law. Nobody will sign off on that. All you have to do is what? Change the National Labor Relations Act a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. It actually is. Wisconsin passed their right to work law based on a privilege granted by the federal government. I mean, compulsory unionism is written into our federal labor policy. That's where it originated back in 1935. And in 1947, under the Taft-Hartley Act, the United States Congress blessed the states with this privilege, quote unquote, I'm using my air quotes, this privilege to exempt themselves from this compulsory unionism scheme by passing right to work laws. So if Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act is repealed, then all 27 right-to-work laws go away in a puff of smoke.
Which is incredible. And you could potentially see this happen.
Yeah, and Ms. Harris has indicated just the other day or over the weekend, I guess, that she would do it. And she thinks she can do it by executive privilege or something. She made some cockamamie constitutional claim that as the President of the United States, she could work and get this done. But that's
unlikely.
Not true.
Unlikely, unless, you know, every judge decided just to, you know, rubber stamp everything she ever wanted to do. But it would ultimately probably come before the U.S. Supreme Court. But all you got to do is change the National Labor Relations Act. But again, you know, when the Republicans had control of Congress, they could have taken out the entire portion of compulsory unionism of the National Labor Relations Act, and they chose to sit on their hands. So, you know, as long as that ticking bomb is there, you know, potentially somebody can detonate the thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it happened in 1965 and 1966. Then President Johnson tried to do it, and it only was because of a tremendous outpouring of opposition from Americans across the country that the Congress stood up and they defeated several attempts to repeal Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act. Bernie Sanders has said he would do it. Ms. Harris has said she would do it. Of course, Elizabeth Warren has said she would do it. I think we're probably going to get keep a scorecard and keep a check mark by each one, because I think they'll all do it, because the big prize here, Vicky, is quote unquote big labor's endorsements as we move into the primary season. That's what they're after.
And big labor's big prize is more forcing more people to cut a portion of their paycheck off automatically to fund the coffers of big labor. What is the union rate right now? What is the unionization rate in the private sector workforce? It's somewhere around 6%. I mean, we're not talking about a huge number of people seeking out the ability to pay somebody to go to work.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's about 6.4% in the private sector, and it's, I think, about 36% in the government sector. But then again, in the government sector, because of the Janus decision that we won back in June of last year, no government employees forced to pay fees to keep their job.
And Janus doesn't apply to the private sector.
That's correct. It does not apply to private sector workers.
So,
that's right.
So it seems to me, Mark, is there another opportunity to be able to get a Janus-like decision regarding private sector workers before one of our, you know, before our vaunted Supreme Court?
We're working on it. I just had a meeting with our legal director and three attorneys about half an hour ago talking about stuff, but I can't, you know, if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
I don't want you to kill me. I shouldn't have even assumed that you hadn't already sat down over a cup of coffee. Maybe as you were looking over at your Vespas parked next to the cafe. But I'm great to have you on the program. I said this a couple of interviews ago. I said, I don't think you're ever going to run out of a reason for your group to exist.
That's for sure. And you spent too much time in Rome, and that's why you have that Vespa. I'm sure that's the case.
I've also sat and watched Roman Holiday now three times. I love that movie. Mark Mix, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks, Vicky.
Good to have you. National Right to Work Foundation, National Right to Work Committee, Mark Mix. We'll be right back.